This is from Business Insider from last week, May 22nd, 2024. Massachusetts millionaire tax is earning more than expected and could help make up for last year's high earners fleeing the state. Massachusetts' new tax on the wealthy generated $1.8 billion, exceeding expectations. Approved in 2022, the tax added 4% on incomes over $1 million. The increased revenue comes amid high-income earners leaving the state. Massachusetts' new tax on the wealthy has become a bigger boon for the state than expected. It could help make up for the loss of high-income earners in recent years. The state announced on Monday that the tax brought in $1.8 billion in the first three quarters of the fiscal year, blowing away predictions for the entire year, according to the Boston Globe. The additional income for the state is already $800 million more than what lawmakers had budgeted to spend from the new tax. The new tax on the wealthy, dubbed, quote, the millionaire's tax, was approved by voters in 2022 and added an additional 4% tax on those earning more than $1 million. According to the Boston Globe, the tax was approved. The state initially estimated it would generate $1.4 to $1.7 billion in the first year. However, the state budgeted just $1 billion for the first year out of concerns that the impact of the new tax could be unreliable in the first year. The new windfall for the state comes despite concerns that high-income earners would leave the state, exacerbating a problem seen in Massachusetts even before the new tax. A study by the Pioneer Institute, published in 2023, shows that Massachusetts saw a net loss of 25,200 tax filers in 2021. Those left the state had adjusted gross incomes of $4.3 billion greater than those who moved in. The change in the number of tax filers increased from the net loss of 20,400 tax filers in 2020 and an adjusted gross income of $2.4 billion. Those who left tended to be middle to high income earners, per the study by Boston Indicators published in April. Most were on the high end, defined as, quote, a family of four with an income of at least $140,000, five times the poverty level of 2022. However, a closer look at the data shows Massachusetts' retention of millionaires is doing just fine. According to the IRS, Massachusetts tax filers with an adjusted gross income of at least $1 million grew by nearly 10,000 in 2021, the year before the new tax was approved. We're in the shadow of Rockford Tower. We're behind enemy lines. We're in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. This is Rob. This is your Highlands Bunker podcast. Hello. As always, Carl is here with me. And today, we're going to get down into some real Delaware dirt, because the man is here. The myth, the legend. It says it right on his shirt. The representative emeritus from Newark's 25th District, John Kowalko. John, how are you?
I'm good, Rob. How are you doing? And Carl, thank you for being here.
I'm doing all right. I mean, dealing with all of the things we've been talking about, it's a little bit maddening. But let's just start out. The first thing that made me mad this session was the fact that free school lunches was not even really considered, because you know, there was no budget item for it. I didn't follow it. I did have somebody from the Working Families Party, Hassani Perkins, come in and talk about it. And I know, you know, that it was filed, but really went absolutely nowhere. Is that an indication of just how the budget really works in the state? Like, if it's not preordained and coming from the executive branch, like, here's your money to go do the thing you wanted to do, that nobody really has the gumption to try to do it in the legislature? Is that really how it works?
That's not supposed to be how it works, but that seems to be how it works right now with the chairs at the House chair and the Senate chairs of the Joint Finance Committee, who have shown a reluctance to challenge the governor's proposed budget, either add things or take things out that shouldn't be in there. And that has been a practice for decades in Delaware, unfortunately, and which to me flies right in the face of the of the difference between and jurisdiction between legislative body and administrative body, executive branch. I mean, the whole idea, and Dennis P. Williams, former mayor of Wilmington at one time, the rep that I work with, used to say, and I believe he was being sincere, he'd say, the governor proposes and we dispose. The governor proposes, we dispose. And he took that very seriously. I don't know to what extent he was challenging things of the governor, but he was very vocal about the separation of jurisdiction, and the budget has to be a making of a budget by the legislative bodies, not by the governor. That's a proposal. That's a proposed thing. So, but I've seen things put in epilogue language. I've seen things put in after the fact, the next term, when they discuss any money overflow in the budget that has been used. I've seen them fund their programs, their pet programs, whether it be a Chamber of Commerce program or whether it be a Corporate Bar Commission program. They fund those. They find the money for them. The corporate giveaways, they find the money for them. So I would say, yeah, this is a big problem in the state of Delaware. This and not only extends just through the budget process, but through legislation that we proposed. This state has allowed itself, its legislative bodies, not all of them certainly agreeing with it, but they've been drugged into this battle of a dulling, an obliteration of the jurisdictional lines, the separation of power lines, and have allowed themselves to become subservient to the governor. And since I've been in office, it's been, I think, when I was in office, I went through three governors, Minner, Markell, and Carney, and to some extent, you always heard they're Democrat governors like we are in the majority, even though when I was at the first term, I was in the minority when Minner was governor. But we are obligated to support their things. And that's bullshit, number one. And number two, even if you wanted to say there's an obligation to try to support the good initiatives from the Democrat governor, because you're a Democrat majority, then it should be qualified with, when is this governor going to stand on his bully pulpit and support the goddamn bills we put up as Democrats? When I put up my bracket bills, it was silence of the lambs from the governor's office to make it more progressive brackets. When I put up other bills, it was silence of the lambs from this governor and even from Governor Markell. And I think that's a sad situation, because when I used to go on conferences out in different states, they would say, oh, you're lucky. You're in a blue state. You have a Democrat governor. You have a majority in the House, a majority in the Senate. And I'd say, no, you're colorblind. If you think that they're wearing blue cloaks to try to cover up what they are. What they are is goddamn Chamber of Commerce, freaking hacks, special interest hacks, who only want to prolong and proliferate their own careers, whether they move on to a branch of federal government, or whether they move on to, or attempt to move on to, a Wilmington mayoral instance. It's to me, it's disgusting, and I think, quite frankly, I can say that it is borderline criminal, certainly unethical.
Well, let me, because this is something that got me sort of peaked, because I talked to Colin O'Mara running for governor, and this was sort of his pitch, was that the budget process is a one-way street. The executive branch decides based on the executive sort of cabal of the Chamber of Commerce and other economic interests, and that's just shoved down the legislature's throat. No changes, no nothing. And whatever is left over in whatever little boxes, maybe you can play with, or not, depending on, you know, what the answer is. And so I never really looked at the budget process that way until sort of Carl and Colin were sort of explaining to me really how it works. And then I think that maybe the day after that happened, there was the announcement that Insight, after being sort of, after their expansion ideas were kicked out by the rich people in Allapocus, got $15 million to move into the Wilmington Bracebridge building, or two Wilmington Bracebridge buildings that were formerly MBNA and Bank of America buildings. And I'm like, well, that's really nice. It's just another, you know, another giveaway. And what I didn't realize, and you were able to give me a little more information about it, the Insight was losing space in their Pennsylvania location anyway. So they had to move somewhere.
Yes.
And once again, rather than just using infrastructure we have and moving them in, we have to incent them in some fashion and pay them to do it. And that's what was done.
Oh, well, what has happened here is that Insight was going to move. And they were going to move here, and that was probably because they have a large presence here now. They were going to move here anyway. I don't care. Anybody wants to tell me otherwise, I'm going to tell them to their face they're a liar. They were going to come here anyway. So now we've thrown $15 million at them to assure that we can say, or to John Carney can say, look what I've done for the city of Wilmington. I've created 300 jobs, and it doesn't cost you a penny. Ignoring the real fact that $15 million that is given to Insight is taxpayer money, and there is nothing in their agreement where I see any kind of a chance of a return on investment to the taxpayer.
No callback.
This has been, even callbacks are not a return on investment. If you put up $10 million to a company, say like Bloom, and 900 jobs, and they don't generate the 900 jobs, you claw back some of the money. You're clawing back, but what is it costing you in addition to that? In the case of Bloom, it's costing ratepayers $15 to $20 million a year, taxpayer slash ratepayers, let's call them that, for a reality check.
Consumers paid the hike
right.
to subsidize
it. This clawback is BS. If it was clawback and if it was real, these giveaways, and then I would say, let's do a flow chart on how many jobs are created and what are you giving per job. And I'll tell you what, it's a substantial amount of money. When I asked for reform of the corporate giveaway program, and that involved like canceling the economic development giveaways, the prosperity partnership giveaways, the strategic fund giveaways, I said we should just cancel them all together. And what we should do is take 10% of that money that we set aside for them, put it into a fund accessible to local Delaware businesses now that are here now. In other words, mom and pop have a store with 10 employees. They want to go to 15 employees, but they're worried about how they can make that investment. So we tell them out of this fund, we will make sure that the additional 5 employees that they hire will not be a tax burden on their business. We will fund it out of this thing. They said they want to expand their business 5,000 square feet, and we will give them credits to expand that. The key is that they have to be already existing local Delaware businesses. They have to be small businesses, because if you look at the facts, and the facts are true about this, 80-something percent, and I won't guarantee that's the exact number, but it's somewhere around 80-something percent of the jobs in Delaware are local business jobs, small business jobs.
Yeah, it's pure ideology. I mean, I read this morning, I think, or yesterday, whenever it came out, the Jake Owens, the Spotlight Delaware story about the port. And, or no, that was, excuse me, about Insight. And then I read Chris Barish's story about the port. And they're both just explaining, you know, Bullock or Eisenberg will just say, well, yeah, I mean, a rising tide lifts all boats. The dry cleaners around there, the business is going to go up. They just say the same thing that they,
fucking bullshit.
They say the same thing.
I'm sorry.
You're right. I think that's the thing I'm getting to is there, because that's their ideology and we've accepted that, those claims are never challenged. And we could see failure after failure of whether you want to say Fisker, you want to say Bloom, you want to say the Emiratis, the Gulftainer at the port in Wilmington. Now we're giving another 190 to the Edgemore port, just basically giving it away. Now a private company will employ longshoremen there. They will employ stevedores and they will employ truck drivers and all of that stuff. But they're doing that because they're running a business.
Exactly.
Like, what do we get out of it?
Nothing.
Well, nothing really. I mean, maybe somebody will get extra takeout at Claymont Steaks or something. I don't know.
No.
But the idea that the idea that they're able to make that argument and everybody's like, oh, okay, great.
Yeah,
that's the argument.
That's the biggest bullshit of it all. The total lack. In the 16 years I was in office, it was a total lack of any return on investment for taxpayers for these investments being made. Markell gave away $250 million during his term, his eight-year term, to 68% of the recipients were the richest corporations in the world, who did not need a goddamn penny of that money, who did not do anything for the taxpayer of Delaware to give it a return on investment. So when you want to say we're going to build up our small business community's abilities to grow or to even exist by saying that they're going to get the chaff from the wheat, I'm going to tell you that's a freaking lie that you're promoting, and the only reason you're doing it is so that you can get support for yourselves and your political ambitions moving forward. And that has always been the case in Delaware. That is the definition of Delaware way. Definition of Delaware way is one thing. That is special interests with the most money, who had the most influence. Special interests with the most powerful people involved have the most influence. Special interests run the state of Delaware. And you can count on your hands the number of special interests that are influenced here. One of them is the Chamber of Commerce. One of them is the Corporate Bar Association. There are a number of these special interests. Any corporate big shot that comes in here to the back door when he used to have in the Depression, a poor homeless person would come ask for a peanut butter sandwich. They drive up in their goddamn limousines with their hand out and say, can you cut me a check, John Carney? Can you cut me a check, Jack Markell, for $50 million? What do you need it for? Well, we don't need it, but make my shareholders much more interested in supporting you. That's the way it works.
Yeah, I always thought it was odd that, because ultimately what they're saying is that the thing that's going to drive anything is the exploitation of the worker. If we can get the worker in here and, you know, the worker pays their taxes and the worker goes and spends their money, that's what drives, like, it's all on you, the worker, to drive everything. Now, we have the money, but we're not giving it to you. We're giving it to the person who's going to exploit your labor. And then you're going to pay your taxes. You're going to pay, you know, higher prices at the gas station, higher prices at the supermarket. That doesn't matter. You individually are the thing that you get, and the way that you run this state is you pay your taxes.
I've witnessed uncountable instances when I was in office, when I'd be arguing about these corporate giveaways. I've witnessed firsthand to my face the Geisenbergers of the world. And Rick Geisberger himself would say, we compute this about how much income tax we're going to get in, how much spending. No, there isn't any way to compare the amount of income tax come in for that employee working here that's going to defray the $20 million you gave to that corporation to do that. That doesn't work that way, and that's the way they do it, though. And you might want to ask yourself then why Rick Geisenberger was, and Jeff Bullock, one of the prime fighters for secrecy and anonymity in corporate and in LLCs, like the prime, I would call it, fighter for that seclusion, for that current Bullock. And then Geisenberger, another one who stands in the way of any kind of fairness in taxing. I want to ask Rick Geisenberger to his face, why did you allow what happened in the Department of Labor to go and you didn't know about it? And when you were made aware of it, you didn't investigate it, and you still haven't investigated to this day.
Yeah.
I want a question from Geisenberger, the bean counter, who has told me on numerous occasions, your tax brackets would drive people out of the state. Markell said the same thing. I said, what are you going to do, get a fucking U-Haul and go to Idaho? Because there's no more pleasant tax environment in the country than Delaware.
Well, that's what,
unless you start going to Wyoming and
that's what
and
Carney told me that to my face one time about. Carney told me that to my face one time to call it capital flight. But yeah. as I mentioned in the
well, you read that article
about Massachusetts. It's just not. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't work like that. Now, people, there is some, you know, a handful of wealthy people will move. That will happen. You know, that happens all over the place. But that doesn't impact. It doesn't really impact, as we're seeing in Massachusetts. It doesn't really impact the result, the benefit of the wealth tax, or what you proposed. You know, a tiered system where well, you know, where wealthy, but whatever it is, it just doesn't. We know that.
I think it's important that your listeners also realize one thing: the most recent bracket remediation I proposed. We created two new brackets, which would have been effective over $500,000 and another one over $1 million. That's individual income in the state of Delaware for the year. So, in other words, they now pay the same amount as a $60,000 earner. The proposal would have been $500,000. You pay above, you earn above $500,000 on your income, taxable income, that's important to know, and you're an individual. The number I came up with was like, I think it was $3,000 a year more in tax burden it would generate, because it's only on the taxes, on the money over a certain amount.
Right, you would only pay the additional rate on dollars you make over 500 grand. So and if you make 550 grand, you would pay the additional tax on the 50 grand over the 500.
Right, right. And Geisberger... Right, you don't pay that, and it was like a 0.75 increase on the first bracket, and I think a total of a 1.25 increase, and that's in order to go from 6 to 7.25 for over $1 million, but it would only be on that over $1 million, and Geisberger told me it would generate $118 million. He gave me a report, $138 million the second year, which would be plenty to fund Medicare costs for maintaining a medical supplement, for a health care reassessment for all of the state employees, the food in schools program, an inspector general's office. I could enunciate 10 different things that it would be, could be paid for out of that, and they are all rejected by people like that Carney, but the Geisberger, I call him. And I called him this during the Markell era, too. He's fucking Rasputin. He's whispering in the ear, and you know, as long as that evil's here. And Bullock was supposed to retire, whatever, 5 years ago. He still runs the show behind the scenes. He's a tainted piece of human who cares nothing about anything but his own career. These people sit there in that governor's office, and all I can imagine is they say, let me justify why I exist, because I'm going to bring you into the new world of, you're going to be promoted as a maker, shaker of everything successful. Ergo, the Insight money, $15 million in the state of Delaware, so can look on a campaign piece. Wilmington mayor, here's your new Wilmington mayor, John Carney. I brought you 300 jobs. I occupied an abandoned building with these jobs, and it didn't cost you anything. And it's going to make Joe down the street's going to be able to sell more hoagies.
What?
That theory.
I completely agree. I want to turn to something you might be able to teach me a little bit more about. So we saw recently another parade of white-coated special interests down at Lake Hall. Because there was a move to create a medical cost sort of oversight board.
Yeah, 350, I believe.
Yeah, to have some sort of medical oversight. And the large interests of Christiana Care and Beebe, you know, had an absolute sort of fit about it. In the same way that the Delaware Bar Association has a fit about their changes, because the legislature in Delaware is here to rubber stamp what business leaders and interests want to do. They're the stakeholders. They determine, and if they come and say, you're cutting into what we do, There's big, I mean, people run around in circles about it. But I knew as soon as they started to turn up that there would be, you know, that there would be some carve outs or some deals made about trying to control healthcare costs. You know, we have not a full monopoly, but we certainly have a situation where, and there's a word for it, it's not coming to mind right now, but where only a certain number of organizations basically have complete control of the market for healthcare. And the idea was to have some sort of democratic oversight into that. And of course, no one sort of likes that. So I don't even know where that stands now. I think they've introduced sort of an amended sort of bill, or they've made sort of changes to it. I'm sure it'll come up here in the last month of the session. What did you make of all of that in the medical side? Because another medical thing that we have been talking about is the seniors for pensioners and retirees, making sure that they get what they're supposed to get and not some sort of privatized Medicare. What's your take all on right. the costs and the seniors Medicare?
Well, one thing I think is important to for me to say, there is a monopoly in healthcare. ChristianaCare has developed it. They wrote a letter when we were when Rise and now Roma were currently fighting for Medi-Fill programs as opposed to the Medicare Advantage from Highmark, and they wrote a letter, ChristianaCare official letter, saying we support the Medicare Advantage. You know, where they shouldn't even been involved in that, shouldn't been engaged in that. It's none of their effing business. Number one. Number two, they are a monopoly. They are a monopoly. Fox Chase wanted to bring a cancer center satellite into the Newport area, I believe it was proposed. And they drummed up the resistance to that with the certificate of need. That was during the Markell era, and they put the kibosh on that, even though Fox Chase had written agreements that they would not be infringing into the market area of ChristianaCare. But ChristianaCare has so much pull, has so much influence. Number two, every one of those white coats down there, I guarantee you, is not a fucking on-the-floor doctor in the health. They are executives in that business. They're the ones with the six figures.
Chief administrators.
Exactly.
We'll say.
Matter of fact, there was even testimony in the white coat from the Nemours people who were cut out of that. They weren't going to be obligated in that. So that's number two. Number three, I think, as importantly as we talk about monopolies, they've generated a per-patient cost that's almost double the national average. ChristianaCare, almost double that. And someone asked me to find the numbers. I don't know, but I did see them. It's like 2,000-something compared to the national average of 1,500-something for a patient, individual patients. And number four, and very importantly, is that ChristianaCare, the original bill, would have not gone in and sat down at the table and said, ChristianaCare, you got to cut this out, this out, this out. It would have been an oversight of their mechanics that they engage in now with recommendations to do that. I supported that version of that bill. You know, 100%, because there is nothing wrong with the oversight, especially of a monopoly. If you can't stop a monopoly from being created or having been created already, you can't dismantle it, then what do you do? Your next best thing is to have an oversight so that it won't be gouging the people. I personally went, I get CAT scans, and if I go to the hospital, it's double, triple the costs. If you went to a satellite outside, which is probably ChristianaCare satellite anyway, but non-hospital grounds. All of these things need some scrutiny so that you can say, you can't just, you know, buy this equipment and then file people in through the door to pay for it. You know, I mean, things like this. That was all part of that single payer bill that I had offered a dozen, maybe longer, years ago with Dr. Foley McDowell, that would have controlled that kind of thing. But the ChristianaCare is a monopoly. The people that testify, they've diluted that bill so much now. I believe they put it in one of the executives from the hospital industry on that committee.
Classic move.
Yeah. They've that bull is castrated. They ain't going to have no more kids. I hope they save the semen, because they have taken that bill and they've rendered it almost useless. And that's the Delaware way. In a prime example of how the Delaware way works, if we can't have, because of public opinion, if we can't have a way to stop you, let me show you a way that is going to make it better. And you read the code on that, we're going to slow it down. We're going to slow it down where it might as well be stopped, because it's going to run out of gas. And that's what they do with their legislation they don't like. That's what the special influences do with legislation they don't like. And then when they come up with legislation they do like this unbelievably corporate bar reform bill that's before us, they run it through, and they have the same dead minds who are loyal to their jobs. Corporate, look them up, corporate attorneys that sit in Dover, they're legislators. You tell me where their check for their $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 salaries coming from. Certainly come from Dover. But if they can go in there and into Dover, sit at their desk and help facilitate advantages for, like, the Corporate Bar Commission, then you know what happens? They are going to be compensated. Let's call it that. And you know, it makes me almost ill thinking about how this has happened, and it continues to happen. It's not how it has happened, because I think it's almost historic. It happened decades ago.
But I think a lot of people.
It continues to happen.
Yeah, I think for the most part, people have just sort of accepted that that's the system and don't want to. Even people outside the system. Like, I'll give you an example that last year with the Leobor reform that we didn't get. You know, we had a package of reforms that were actually going to be halfway decent. They told everybody to eat shit. They told us to go fuck ourselves, and they passed 205 and 206. These are dog shit. Yep. Now, we kind of knew that going into it, but okay, fine. That's all they're going to do. We can't, you know, it's like this is what they're going to do, because the cops, you know, they're part of this. They're part of the, you know, like you were. There's several sort of institutions in the state that kind of keep everything up. You mentioned a few earlier. The cops are another one.
And that is one of the groups, yes.
So they changed the name of, you know, COPT to POST, which is what most people, you know, most of the states use as sort of a training and review board. But again, that's not, you know, and they said, oh, we're gonna give more information to the what do you call it, the Judicial Committee, the CJC, right, the Criminal Justice Committee, or Commission, or Council, whatever it is. They don't. They sent one. They've sent so far one misconduct report to the CJC. It was about the guy from drug and alcohol and tobacco that stole the cigarettes for drugs. I just love that one, because it's so old fashioned. It seems like it happened like 100 years ago, you know. But yeah, I mean, we make a half assed sort of stab at something and then pat ourselves on the back, and then the biggest issue is once that happens. Once we do something half-assed and pat ourselves on the back, trying to get back to it is impossible.
You're absolutely right. That's a point I'm glad you brought up, because I've said this many times about many different bills, legislation, proposals, regulations that were in place. One thing that the General Assembly in Delaware does very well is find an excuse so they can say, we did that. We did our best. Punches Pilate. Give us Barabbas. We're done with you. We're done with that. Now we've accomplished that. No, you didn't. And my heart goes out to the ones that stand up and say, no, that's wrong.
I think what's happening, and this is something Carl has harped on since I first met him, since we first started talking, the idea in Delaware, the Delaware way, is like these institutions are in place, and whatever you get, you have to get from inside these institutions. This is wrong. We need to start building alternative parallel institutions to exert pressure on these people. Because the issue is, because I'm in a, I don't want to say the same, but I'm in a similar sort of situation as you were. You were independent. You had the backing of your constituents and were able to do your work the way you wanted to do it. I have a similar thing, not at Legg Hall, but I have a sort of a similar sort of launching pad, and I can kind of say the stuff I want to say, and nobody can tell me what to say. Because I'm not dependent upon, you know, the institution liking me to get a lawyer job or to get a better job in retirement because I'm a cop or whatever. I'm not dependent upon that. And so until we find ways to get people to be not dependent on those institutions that are here, we're going to be in a similar situation because there's not going to be enough people. You need to work within a parallel institution, not just as one person throwing lobs up against the wall, because that's the situation that we're getting in. But I think that's actually happening, is to exert some pressure from a more institutional structure than just, you know, because they're going to want to marginalize. I mean, you see this right now in Legg Hall and the governor's mansion. They're trying to marginalize, you know, the Working Families Party. They're trying to marginalize all of these different orgs, especially that support electoral politics and are running candidates, because they're a threat to these people.
Yeah.
They're a huge, huge threat. That's good. Whenever I hear that everybody hates Working Families Party, I know that Carl and Cheyenne and everybody at Working Families Party are doing exactly what they need to be doing. Because the more that people get mad, it means they feel the pressure, that they're under scrutiny, they're going to get primary challengers, they're going to have people show up at their office, all of that stuff, and they don't like it. That's good. But that has to – people need – you know, I know it's kind of like, you know, preaching to the choir with this group. But yeah, it's very, very important that whatever sort of structure or institution or organization you can get behind, sign up with them and work it that way, because otherwise, you know, you are easily marginalized.
Oh no, exactly. I actually feel that my retirement date, I became more subject to being marginalized than I have experienced that. I mean, I no longer have the bully pulpit that I have, even the newspapers.
You utilize the press more than pretty much anyone. And then you see, even, you know, we were talking about Spotlight Delaware, a new sort of independent thing, and I want that to work. I love Carl Baker. He's done such great work. But then I see some of the other stuff that's coming out from there, and, you know, interviews with Carney and talking about how great the Insight deal was. And I'm just like, we're back at fucking square one now.
Exactly.
Like, okay, you're independent. Why are you independent if you're gonna run an article about this building we purchased for Insight and say, you know, what a boon it is to the Wilmington economy? Well, and have no other context in there other than what you're being told by the prosperity people and by the people who gave them this money. No other context at all.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I've co-founded Rise Delaware, and that I've helped in forming ROMA, Retirees Opposed to Medicare Advantage, that I've become 10 times more active, even though I was active in some ways over the years of my career, with Delcog, because these are institutions that are now getting more recognized for what they try to do, because they are organizations, they are institutions, they are more populist than one raving lunatic and screaming at the darkness. You know, John Kowalko, it's much better to be with these. And that's why I've done that. And I've also continued to write. But you have much more influence to affect people if you are with a group or unit. Before I got elected to office, and I don't know before I even considered running for office, I was starting a movement, full day kindergarten was my thing. Actually, Melody Smith was even thankful of it. So I went to the Newcastle Parade or Newport Parade, whichever one they have here. It might have been Ellesmere, And I got 1,300 signatures on a petition supporting funded full-day kindergarten. So I took them down to Leghall, and Melanie Smith said, this is great. I love this. This will be good for the education committees. And at the time, my opponent, incumbent opponent, Ulbrich, was opposed to that. But I hadn't yet, you know, decided I was going to run for office. So, you know, I decided that, okay, I can't do this on my own. So I called up, I forget which department it is, but for $35, you can form a company. And I formed the Citizens for Legislative Accountability. I was the executive officer. My wife was a treasurer, and Ernie Lehman, one of my guys who worked on my campaign, was the secretary. And we formed this thing. And I go down to Leg Hall during a budget hearing, and the reporter says, John, because I was known then as an activist for working with Acorn on a relief program for people's utility bills. Anyway, I walk, I'm going into the chamber, into the Senate chamber for the hearings, and the reporter said, what are you doing down here, John? I says, well, I'm here to present these petitions, you know, on behalf of the Citizens for Legislative Accountability. You know, really sounds good. Sounds better than for John Kowalka went to a parade and got him. I go in there, and there's the Secretary of Education, Valerie Woodruff. And she knew me personally. She goes, John, what are you doing? And she had a big grin on her face. And I said, I'm bringing these copies of these 1,300 signatures for fully kindergarten. And all of a sudden, the smile went off her face because she was smiling and shaking my hand. And I said, I'm going to present them to the committee. So the next day, front page of the news show, but when they used to have a front page worth watching, not an ad for a Dairy Queen opening in Rehoboth.
You're not a fan of the big Chick-fil-A opening in Smyrna?
It's always top on my list. Well, the front page, I mean, half a page picture of me handing these to Valerie Lawyer with a big grin on her face, and it says, John Kowalka, Executive Director of Citizens for Legislative Accountability, presenting signatures for the full day kindergarten funding. It passed shortly after. And, you know, that initiative, that's when I realized, like you just said, the value of an organization. I mean, I created that 2 days before that, but I saw the need for it to try to get recognition. Every time that you have a standalone person, they're going to endure almost not negativity, but they're going to endure almost an attempt to obliterate their existence. You know, and that's why you need organizations, because when I was in Dover as a legislator, they couldn't turn my mic off, even though Pete would have loved to do that. But he never wore his brown shirt, so I didn't feel he was very authoritarian if it was without the official stamp of what he was in my eyes. And I will say that I've lost a lot of that influence, and I hope the people with some of the Working Families Party people will that have been successful, and the ones that I hope will be successful.
I mean, before we
listen and hear that call, because
yeah.
I'm very disappointed. Some of the names on the
corporate
sponsors
bill.
On the corporate bill.
Well, let's get to it.
Used to be two people.
Well, what I'll say about the first thing before we get to that corporate bill is that I think what you have done, and we've said it from the beginning of like our, you know, some of our media work. Certainly, you've given people a way to go. You've inspired people to join up and continue the work, and you've supported these groups all the way through. Whether it's the people joining the DSA or the Working Families Party, or even getting together with Roma and Rise, all of that stuff. So yeah, I mean they can turn your microphone off now, but now we have more people who are sort of eager to jump in the fight, which is good. But let's get to the corporate thing because I know we're running tight on time. So once again, the bar has passed us us. Well, it's supposed to be us. The legislature is supposed to represent us. They don't. But they've written new rules and sent them over. Now, last year, as we know and has been reported in the call, you know, Medina was able to raise some questions on the floor, get 11 sort of dissenting votes on the floor, or 11 votes for her amendment that didn't pass. What people were told is that this year, because of that, we'll get more time, we'll have more debate, we can answer your questions, and all that was a big lie. So people, the first thing people need to remember is that the lobbyists that came in from the Corporate Law Council with the sponsors, I think last year it was Kyle Gay and Krista Griffith in the House, I think because of the two attorneys, they were liars. They lied. Because this bill came over, it was very controversial. I think in an unprecedented fashion, it had, I think, at least two dissents in the executive committee at a bar and one abstention, I think, or maybe multiple abstentions. Both Vice Chancellor Laster and Chancellor McCormick have written public comments that this is not the right thing to do. They're probably going to do it anyway. It's Senate Bill 313, I believe. And the issue with it, I hesitate to explain it because I think 80% or 90% of the people who are going to vote on it in a couple of weeks don't understand it. So I hesitate to explain it to them to make them feel like they understand it better. But really what it boils down to is there was a case in front of the Court of Chancery a few months ago called Mullis. And what Vice Chancellor Laster found was that they were in violation of a law that because they were basically creating contracts that would circumvent the power of the board of directors. The board of directors of a company is supposed to be sort of the mouthpiece of the shareholders, and they're supposed to be sort of in a quasi-democratic way, managing the firm. But for what we're told is a long time, decades even, in some responses I've seen, the companies, corporations in Delaware have been doing what they're calling, they've been doing these side deals, these side contracts to circumvent the power of the board all of this time. Well, now they got caught. Laster says you can't do it, it's illegal. They appeal it to the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court has yet to hear this case. But even before that, what the Corporate Law Council has decided is to send the Delaware General Corporate Law changes to the legislature and already changed this. So, and their answer, the talking points that we're hearing from senators and representatives is twofold. Number one is, well, this is standard market practice. They've been doing this all along, so we need to change the law to match what they're doing, which sounds fucking stupid on every count. It's just like, yes, they've been doing this illegal thing. Well, they got caught. We went and adjudicated it. The vice chancellor wrote an opinion that they don't like. So we were doing the illegal thing. So let's just change the law. In no other area of legislation or governance or jurisprudence or criminal justice or whatever can I think that that's ever really been a thing. Now maybe marijuana. You know, everybody was breaking the law anyway, so they just wound up changing the law. But that didn't have any kind of fiduciary impact. You know, this is changing the law for all of these companies and allowing them to do this thing. The other thing is a classic Delaware way sort of talking point. Jordan Howell in the call has documented all of these different dissents from corporate law professors at Harvard, corporate law professors at Michigan, corporate law professors at Boston University. Organizations and institutional investment organizations around the country. Well, these are outside agitators. These are people from outside Delaware, don't really know what we're doing. Well, they do really know what we're doing, and they think it's fucking stupid. That's the problem. And, you know, anytime anybody from outside the state has anything to say, they're just shouted down like, well, but you're not from Delaware. You don't know how we do it. This is how we do it. Now, I wonder how that applies to Vice Chancellor Laster and Chancellor McCormick, or the two people who dissented on the Delaware corporate law section of the bar and the executive committee. They're Delaware people. So I don't know if that one holds water, but I know I passed along to you some information, and I know you're not pleased either, just because, you know, everybody wants to get their name on that rubber stamp. Everybody wants their name on co-sponsor, additional sponsor, house sponsor. Everybody wants their name on that rubber stamp.
And 98% of those people on that bill, 98%, close to 100% maybe, do not know what the fuck that bill is doing or intended to do. They are just carrying that water. And what a bill like this does, and the previous bills from the corporate always had, to me, a threat to either some kind of a corporate identification, different things, different initiatives. But this one, to me, looks like a very distinct effort to manipulate the Chancery Court, to interfere with the Chancery Court and its, I guess you would call it, its independence. We have one of the selling points of Delaware is you have a Chancery Court that is steeped in tradition, I think a couple hundred years, longest one in the country, and has, I guess you would say, done its job fairly well. And it has not been only leaning against corporate interests. It's probably been more in favor of corporate interests and decisions like that, as opposed to the shareholder interests in a lot of cases. And that certainly can be argued, but it's been now that the Corporate Bar Commission starts instigating a change in the law to tie the hands of the Chancery Court, then we are in a world of hurt. And it appeals to corporations. They want the advantage. I would like to see the shareholders have an equal say in this. And I guarantee you, they wouldn't be, if the ones that are aware. Now, you got to understand, people have share. The ones that are aware, I'm sure they wouldn't approve of this kind of thing.
No, and again, and I forget the woman's name. You'll have to refer to Jordan's work on this. But, you know, organizations that represent, you know, investors, the people you're talking about, they're not pleased. Now, obviously, not every individual investor is tied to, you know, some sort of like a group that represents their interests. But even they are pulling the alarm bell. So, you know, I think because you're seeing Laster and McCormick speak out in public, I think what you're saying is exactly right. This is a way to undermine a court of chancery. That, you know, the idea, I think, is that, well, companies are doing this and we want to just keep doing it. Why are you telling us we can't do it? Oh, you told us we can't do it. Well, who are you to tell us we can't do it? We're going to go to the bar and they're going to change the law and say we can do it.
And it'll be in the most influential court in the world. And that is the Chancery Court. Chancery Court is the most influential corporate court in the world. In the world. And if you start dictating how their decisions are going to be limited, then you are dictating policy that you do not belong in the arena dictator. And if you want to sit there and whatever the names are on these corporate the bills or sponsor, co-sponsor, and you want to tell me you know what the fuck you read, or if you even want to tell me you read it, I would say to your face, you're a liar. You don't know what's in there. You don't care what's in there. You're on board the fucking train, the gravy train, the Delaware Way train. You know, that is frustrating to me, and I can really appreciate the judges, Lassiter and the other judge that you mentioned, having the bravery to stand up and say, no, this is wrong. Because now that argument doesn't wear these are outside agitators. No, they're goddamn intellects. They're corporate intellects. They're not agitators. What they are is knowledgeable people, which I challenge any of the goddamn sponsors on this bill to show me their credentials for analyzing this bill. So you just show me. And don't tell me I read the synopsis, because that synopsis is almost unwieldy enough to leave.
It's a synopsis. It's tough. I'm just counting on the experts that I know to help me through it.
I know some experts that have told me in law, I said, that's a terribly written bill. not just grammatically and everything, but yeah, grammatically. I mean, these are professionals.
I think Laster and McCormick, at least I think they both sort of hit on that. That even in the even as you read through the draft, you're just like, well, this isn't clear.
No, it's not, and that's deliberate. The two reasons you don't have things clear when the corporate bar commissioner or whatever come up and write these bills. Two reasons. One, number one is it's deliberate so you don't see through the haze. Number two is so they can say next year, oh, we got to refine this. It wasn't clear. And then they're going to take another step on your rights, on the rights of investors, on the rights of actual people. They're going to take another step on your fucking face. That's what they do. That's what they intend to do. That's what they always intend to do. If the state of Delaware wants to reform the mechanisms of doing law and get Delaware, then they should have a full-time legislative body compensated fairly and forbidden to have another job until they're done being a public elected official. I mean, anybody. You have jobs with Powell, Val Longhurst, jobs with jobs for Delaware graduates or whatever the hell that thing that the coal board runs, of six-figure payments, people influencing decisions that are made in this state with the money, don't recuse themselves, but they got another job. Corporate attorneys getting a huge check from their corporate masters and coming down here for $45,000, $50,000 to take care of the needs of the people. Give me a freaking break. Let's make it a full-time job. Double the salary while you're in there. You can't have another job.
I couldn't agree with you more. Last question.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I think I mentioned I had Colin O'Mara in here. Obviously, I've talked to Matt.
And I talked to Colin, by the way, for 20 minutes at a 25th District fundraiser. I talked to Colin personally.
So here, I'll just say this. I was going to save this for like a patrons only. I'm just going to say what I think, and then I want to get your thoughts as a final thought. I was skeptical because I sort of came out of left field for me. Like, I knew who Colin was, but it didn't seem like it fit what I thought the direction we were going to go in. I say we, I mean either the Movement Left, that project, or the Working Families Party project. I'm starting to come around to it. And this is why. The arguments against Colin O'Mara are sort of what he did at Denrec, which wasn't great. And we talked about that here. He was part of the Markell administration. He was a younger person. He was in his 20s when he started. And so, not that I'm going to give anybody a pass, but I want to see people reflect on that portfolio of work and feel like they learned their lesson. Okay, that's the one thing. The second thing is, well, his wife ran for governor of Maryland, and they keep separate residences, and that's a private. It seemed to me the way he spoke about it, I don't want to pry into his private life. But he has a home here. His kids go to school here. He votes here, all that stuff. And frankly, if there's someone who understands this imbalance between the legislature and the executive branch, and understand some of the stuff we were talking about the budget situation and how once that gets passed to the legislature, you get what you get. Whatever money's in those little boxes, that's what you get. You can't touch any of the other stuff, really. And we decide from the executive branch all the big stuff, and you can play around in this little sandbox if we let you. He seems to understand that and wants to change it. So, actually, I don't even think I care if he lived in fucking Maryland, to be honest with you. If he wanted to do that, I don't care if he lived in fucking California. And so I changed my registration last week by the deadline, and I think I'm going to vote for Colin O'Mara. Just for those reasons, because I don't give a shit where he's from.
Well, let me tell you.
What do you think?
I'm not going to say what I think.
You don't have to tell me what you're going to do.
My experience was when I discussed with Colin as a fundraiser, 25th District fundraiser, when I discussed various aspects of our where we mutually we had mutual crossroads in our careers. He was Denrek, and I was chair of the Energy Committee, And as chair of the Energy Committee on the last week of the session, came up the Bloombox proposal. And I reminded Colin that I was really skeptical for a number of reasons. Number one, I didn't want it to be called a renewable energy source, because it's not. It's not. And Colin said, yeah, at the time, the investors will, or the law won't pass unless it's declared renewable. And number two, I said, I don't agree, and I said this to Markell and him, I agree with 300,000 ratepayers being held responsible for the surcharge. It should be the taxpayers. And the answer was quite direct. Well, if we have the taxpayers responsible, that law could be changed next year. The contract could be broken, and that costs a lot of money, and blah, 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 blah. And I promise you, John, it'll never go over $1.15 a month. That was a fucking lie. And then the other thing I mentioned was the fact that there was no return on investment for the blue boxes. I don't care about the clawback for the jobs created. And then Markell called me and said, it's in your district. Are you going to explain to your constituents why you said no to 900 jobs? And I was really insulted and pissed, because that's not the way I do business. But I had to take a deep breath, and I said, okay, it wouldn't have passed if I didn't support it. I'll be honest with you. That's how much influence I had as chair of the Energy Committee. I've apologized that, as an intervener at Public Service Commission meetings during the six years that I went there, I always started my remarks with, first, let me offer my apologies for my vote and my support for the Bloom Project. It was wrong. It's wrong. It's costing ratepayers million, 20 million, 30 million a year. Anyway, and I said that to Colin. He said, you know, John, I don't disagree with you. But then he said, which I detected a sincerity in it, he said, yeah, I was young, and this is something the governor wanted. So he was willing to, I don't think he believed it was going to go way up, but he was willing to suppress his objections to it, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And that made me do it. So that was the one personal interaction with him that I had, that I've had publicly have said. Now, nothing absolves me from being the one who did what I did. You know what I mean? His missteps don't absolve me, but I'm looking at him as a potential candidate. Then I talked to him about tax practice and the way we do the budget process, and we pretty much mirrored each other. So I told him, as I told other people that are running, to their main advisor, and I won't say who, I said, the first candidate for the primary, the first gubernatorial candidate that comes up to me and said they're going to fire Geisenberger, they're going to fire Saron Cade, they're going to fire Clarity Mattis, and they're going to fire Jeff Bullock, they're going to replace them, will be the candidate that I will say has earned my endorsement. I haven't heard back from any of them, but and they might think it's a high bar, but you know what? Screw that shit. That person, Geisenberger, Rasputin, has been a prime stone in the shoe of the public. He doesn't give a shit about poor people, about working class people, about average people. He gives a damn about the Delaware Way and preserving the Delaware Way and the Chamber of Commerce and all the freaking fundraisers they want to hold and how they want to integrate it to the minds of people. I want that changed, promise of that change. And, you know, I think it was one of the candidates' response was, that would be very discouraging for them to finish out their job. I don't care.
Yeah, I don't care either.
Fuck them if they
well, see, you're, and you're in a different. First of all, number one, I agree with everything you just said. All of those people are evil, evil scum that I hope to never. When I do see them in public, I want to be sick for the reasons that you said. Claire DeMatteis especially, just because of the Department of Corrections connection. But in any case, you're right about that. But you are in a different sort of position because of who you are and the work that you've done as far as endorsement. I'm not endorsing anybody. Yeah. I'm just telling you what I think I'm going to do. I don't care. I don't actually care what anybody does. I really don't at this point. I don't think there's any... I don't think there's anything out there that anybody can get really excited about, at least not for me here in Wilmington. There are a few, and we've talked about them before, the Brandon Fletchers of the world who are excellent. But for me, there's nobody. As I said before, I'm definitely going to vote for Velda Potter because I'm just going to do that. Now, is that an endorsement? No. I don't care what the fuck anybody does. But that's what I'm going to do because I don't like John Carney. I put John Carney in the same group as the four individuals you just mentioned.
Exactly.
And so I'm not doing that. The one thing I will endorse is if you see John Carney in public, I can give that guy a raft of shit because he doesn't like it and there's nothing he can do about it. So he could keep you off a committee. You can't do shit to me, so I tell him to stick it whenever I can. John, it was great to see you.
It was good to see you
guys.
I'm so glad you came up. I urge your listeners to look at names of people who sponsor these certain bills, 313, and look at their willingness to get along, or to try to make points and understand that that's not the way it should be, and that's not the way it should be acceptable.
Yeah, and here's a little teaser for next week. For next week, we're going to have a huge sort of roundtable discussion about 313, the corporate stuff, again. We'll have our own experts telling you what's what. We'll have Chance from Chancery Daily. We'll have our intrepid reporter on the street, Jordan Howell. We'll have, hopefully, the Delaware Call senior legal correspondent, William C. Martin Esquire. And you know, Carl will be here, too. But so there'll be more on that, mark my words. But again, John, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Carl, thanks for everything you're doing. And you already know this, so I'll just say it to the listeners. Left is best.